When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Remember the whole truckers for Trump? We're going to boycott New York City. We're going to shut the city down. There'll be nothing on the shelves. We'll show you. How dare you? You have a judgment of $355 million against Donald Trump. How dare you hold him accountable for doing bad things? How dare you? And I said at the time, going, this is just a handful of nitwits, a couple of ratchet jaws out there looking for attention. And they got it, because you've got a right wing echo chamber posing as a media outlet or a series of outlets just spewing this stuff. And you know, the F channel, breaking news, truckers for Trump going to boycott, no freights getting into New York. And I go, I watched the bridge cameras. I watch the cameras going in and out of New York going, I see trucks. I see lots of trucks. I see as many trucks as I probably did a week ago. When I drive into New York, I see lots of trucks. What happened? Is it possible? Because it reminds me, you remember when the truckers were going to shut down Washington, D.C.? Oh, the trucker convoy going to shut down D.C.? It reminded me of the guy from Scranton, Pennsylvania, just up the road from me, who owns a small trucking company and decided he was going to take one of his trucks on the road. And he decorated it with all kinds of, you know, we love Trump and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And he couldn't find, Washington, D.C. Now, he's got the big truck, couldn't find how to get to Washington, D.C. Kept taking the loop around, you know, got to Baltimore and found his way around there, but could not get, truck driver, couldn't get to D.C. This made me think of the truckers for Trump, their boycott of New York City. Is it possible? Is it possible that they could have just, I don't know, not knew how to get there? So they didn't not show up? Or they got lost. Maybe that's what it was. They got lost. It's. I know it's not funny, but it is. The sad reality is our media, run by big corporations and a lot of right-wing voices, keep throwing stuff at us that don't matter. One guy in Chicago says, we're going to boycott. We're going to boycott New York City. And it becomes a massive story. It's almost like they're hoping that they can get truckers to go, we're not going. And they found a couple of people to say that, but it was a handful. Again, the roads were full of trucks. And if these handful of nitwits don't go, someone else will. And this is the problem I have with our mainstream corporate-controlled right-wing media. And they don't do it just with this. They do it all the time with what they're pushing, whatever the outrage candy of the day is, whatever the divisive issue, the trans bathroom issue, it's back. And we're hearing more about trans and trans kids. You know what? I don't care about that. That's not an issue that working people should be fighting over. That's a family issue. It's a personal issue. You know, this is one of those things that makes you go, what exactly is wrong with us as a country? I was just looking at a story that Missouri is trying to pass a piece of legislation, a new bill that would punish teachers with sex offenses, make them put them on a list for contributing to the transition of a minor. If they treat them decently, if they call them by their preferred pronouns or do anything to just be decent to someone. Sex offender list. And you go down this thing of they need the outrage so that we aren't paying attention to all the other things that really need attention. This issue has gotten so much attention legislatively. I wish they would spend that kind of attention on, oh, I don't know, ending poverty? Oh, I don't know, getting education for everyone? Getting health care for everyone? I don't know, fixing the potholes in front of my house. Something constructive. But again, what they do masterfully is they distract us with things that don't affect our lives. If you have a kid that's a trans kid, get him or her what they need. That's a family decision. Shouldn't be done by the government. The same thing with in vitro fertilization. That shouldn't be a government thing. It should be a family thing. But boy, we're getting all worked up. Yeah, we see at the border, oh, there's criminals, all these criminals. And you ask people, have you been affected at all in any way, shape, or form by what's going on at the border? Have you been crimed? Have the immigrants come and taking your stuff? No. In fact, New York Times had a story that said that, you know, by having immigrants coming in, taking jobs that we can't fill, it's actually helped the economy a little bit, which is generally how fresh waves of immigrants do help the economy. Take jobs that most people won't take at the desperation wages that corporate America is willing to pay. Now, me, I've been saying for a long time, we got to organize those jobs. Don't care who's doing them. They should be living wage jobs. But we're hell-bent on cheap labor. But you don't hear that. And what's frustrating is the right-wing media in this country isn't, they're not giving you facts. They're not just reporting the news. They're putting in their opinion. They're putting in their direction. You know, the Truckers for Trump thing. That was never going to be anything. They wanted it to be. Oh, boy, did they. They wanted, they needed that story. It just didn't materialize. There was no there. And you go, at some point, do we not turn the channel? Right now, here in my state of Pennsylvania, they've created an election security task force. They're going to spend a whole bunch of resources putting people into voting polling places, and you know, so that no one's intimidated, so that everyone has the right to vote. Because there's a movement on the right that, well, they're going to start intimidating people. And for what? Oh yeah, because the right-wing media has sold a bunch of people on the idea that they're so insecure. You know, there's a Democrat and a Republican watching. And you can't trust any of those people in the polling. Can't trust people. And what's frustrating about it is so many people are falling for it because it's all they're hearing. It's all they're getting. And if that's all you're getting and it's all you're surrounded with, it's what you're going to believe. If fear is the only true north for a lot of these media outlets, what happens to their reporting? What happens to the news? What happens to what they're telling us? It all becomes about misinformation and disinformation. Or what we used to call when I was a kid, lies, BS, nonsense. But we've bought it hook, line, and sinker. As a society, this is what and where we've gone. Instead of saying, hey, how do we make people's lives better? We've got a news industry committed, dedicated to division, to pitting us against each other so that things don't get done that make our lives better. For me, true north is always, how do we make working people's lives better? That's the true north. How do we make average everyday families, how do we make it so that they can get ahead, so that they can have opportunity? Our political class doesn't even talk about that, which is why we have to be fighting for it, which is why we have to be standing up and coming together, especially in these moments. I got to tell you, it's insane to me. But I'll tell you, I want to see the Trucker for Trump. I want to see them. I just can't find one. Like I said, I spent a half hour one day at a truck stop just begging people. You a trucker for Trump? Some of them like Trump, but they weren't boycotting anything. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, New Hampshire lawmakers voted 212 to 186 to indefinitely postpone House Bill 1388. And you go, what is that? Well, that would have made New Hampshire a no rights at work state. And look, this has been like the third, fourth time. It seems like every legislative session, there is a movement in New Hampshire to try and, you know, screw over the working people there. What this vote means, though, is that at least for this session, right to work cannot be considered again for this session. Trust me, I'm sure they'll probably be back. But the question is this like the third swing at it? When do you, in what game do you get unlimited numbers of swings? But here to share some thoughts on, well, how this latest attempt got put down and, you know, could this finally be out? I've asked our good friend Liz McElroy to come talk with us. Liz is the Vice President of Government Affairs with the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, their website, iupat.org. Liz, thanks for taking time for us.
Yes, it's great to be here, and it's great to see you again, Rick.
Yeah, it's good to see you again, especially under these circumstances that this nonsense gets put down again in New Hampshire. How many times are they going to keep trying this?
I mean, I can't answer that question because I'm not the one introducing right-to-work legislation, but you're right. I mean, you know, you said that this has been a few years. It's been more than that. It's been a decade, I think, where they bring it up. And, you know, I was sort of refreshing my memory on it. And I think it's been enacted and vetoed. It's been introduced and tabled. It's been passed by one chamber or another, but not the other. So basically everything that could happen to a piece of legislation except getting it passed into law has happened with Right to Work in New Hampshire, and they just keep coming at it. And I think it's a real testament to the workers and the labor movement of New Hampshire that they keep mounting a fight to make sure people know what it is, what it isn't, and get it defeated every year.
And the thing that gets me is the moneyed interest never seem to run out of money pursuing this. So I think it's important. Let's start with what is Right to Work and how how would it affect people if it's enacted in your state?
Yeah, so you know, I think a lot of people think it's you know what the proponents of it say is that it means that you don't have to be forced to join a union, which you're not forced to join it. Nobody can be forced to join a union anyway. What Right to Work law does is really limits the ability of workers and their unions to to be active in their states, right? And so what it does is it means that you can't collect certain dues from work people who are not you can't collect fees from people who aren't members necessarily to join the union, which is something that happens anyway. These are like not laws that are necessary, and they limit the laws. In particular, this law in New Hampshire would have also affected the way dues can be collected, right? Which we see a lot of. We see dues deduction being limited in a bunch of states, and so it's you know, oftentimes when you see a right to work push, you see other things that are going to limit the ability of workers to organize themselves and work with their coworkers to balance the interests of their employer.
Ultimately, what it is it's a way of starving unions of the resources to go out and do the organizing that has to be done and enforcing contracts that are already in place. So yeah. What you're doing is you're basically just neutering them. And I think our listeners and viewers, they get that. But I want to make sure everyone understands that there are no rights here. You know, I've had to say, well, I should have the right to work. And I agree. Everyone should have the right to a job. Everyone should have rights on the job. That's not what this is.
Yeah, and that's really important. I mean, it's a real testament to the messaging and the wordsmith, right? Right to work sounds like a good thing, but it's really not, and it's bad for workers. It's bad for, you know, we see the states that have right to work laws in place, and you see unionization rates decrease, and just even the ability of workers to come together with their coworkers, even not in union, right? Just to take concerted action and things like that. And you see the impact that has across those states. You know, you see lower wages, you see lower safety standards, you see all those things that go hand in hand with when workers' rights are being depressed in a particular state.
Especially
in a particular industry.
Especially in the world that you're in the building trades. I mean, you know, the numbers are fairly conclusive. In states that have this designation as right to work, you're talking about lower wages, less health care, lower retirement security, and sadly, higher injury rates and death rates on the job. That, to me, that's the big part of it. Because, you know, especially for our building trades friends, you know, that safety part, that ability to push back against working conditions, I think that's kind of a big thing.
Yeah, it is. It is obviously inherently dangerous. Industries like the construction industry and others really do need those protections and need that ability to say to employers, you know, hey, we need to check on this. We need to check. It's a balance. It's a balance check. And so it really is important. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, I mean, I know you've done shows on this one already, but like Michigan last year repealed it, right? And so there's real evidence in states that have had it for a while that it didn't actually do the things that its proponents claim it's going to do. And so people, I think, are now starting to take a look at that and say, maybe we went, you know, we need to go in the other direction.
Well, so, you've got
certainly New Hampshire has defeated it enough times, so it's definitely in their minds. So.
Yeah, no, and the money interests are never going to give up. That was the answer to that. Because they keep pushing this because they know it means more for them and less for working people. But to your point, you had West Virginia Governor Jim Justice come out and say, hey, you know, we did everything that they told us to do. We passed your right to work. We did away with prevailing wage. We did all this stuff, and the jobs didn't come flowing in like manna from heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't happen to think that it's about job creation like some people, like the proponents of it, want to say it is. It's about repressing workers, and it's about repressing the rights of people to get together. It's about that power, right? You're talking about the moneyed interest, but it's also the power of being able to control every facet of my life, including my work life, you know? And so, not mine, obviously, but you know, the lives of their employees, and it's, you know. Oh, and listen, like I said, it's tied to other things. You mentioned prevailing wage, right? We see, you know, prevailing wage laws going away in states, right? We see all those same attacks from the same people, just, you know, piecemeal on different parts of the industry, different parts of different sectors of workers.
Yeah, and look, you know, this is just one of the numerous attacks that we see put on by corporate America and the wealthy. And, you know, it's one of these things where my grandfather always said, if a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. So every time I see them spending this money on pursuing this right to work stuff or going after prevailing wage, I'm going, for whose benefit? Certainly not mine. But this isn't the only attack. And I look at, you know, places like Iowa and Missouri, where there are legislative attacks on workers' rights happening as we speak. They never seem to run out of bad ideas on how to harm working people.
Yeah, I mean, the Iowa thing is interesting. I don't know. I think you said you've talked about this before with the Iowa, the public sector, limiting public sector. What they're trying to do now is really even take away. Right now, it's like you get a list, you go to an election, you know, you keep your union, which is happening all over Iowa. And so they realized it backfired. And now they're trying to go a step further. And basically, if the employer misses some deadlines, the union can be decertified. And that's just, crazy to me, right? But it's part of this pattern, right? And like they tried something, it didn't quite work the way they intended. Workers overwhelmingly have been voting to keep their collective bargaining in Iowa. And so they decided they needed to go a step further. So
yeah, I know in talking with a few of our friends who are state reps there, the numbers of people in the public sector have actually been growing a little bit because of this. Because it seems that when you want to take something away from someone, they kind of want to keep it.
I mean, yeah, I think that's a human instinct, right? But I think it's also that people are getting tired, right? It's these relentless attacks on working people. And to your point, they're spending a lot of money to do it, and it becomes a distraction, and people have to go out and fight to keep their union, just to keep their their right to have one. And it's exhausting. People are tired. We represent some public employees in Iowa, and it's an ongoing conversation with folks. But it's designed that way, right? It is designed by the moneyed interests, as you say, to keep us fighting the same battles.
So, how much of this, Liz, do you think is because you said it's exhausting, and it is. Just to hold on to what you have, let alone be able to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, all that stuff. Just holding on is exhausting. How much of it do you think is just that? They want you burning through resources, time, energy, just holding on to what you got so that maybe you don't expand and bring more folks in.
Oh, I think I imagine that's a lot of it. Again, I'm not in those meetings, in those think tanks, but I mean, I imagine that's a lot of it, right? If they just keep workers and unions fighting sort of the basics, then it's, they think it's harder for us to regroup. I think they underestimate. We see a lot of evidence of workers in across different sectors, public, private, retail, food service, right? All of these things that are happening where people are kind of standing up and saying enough is enough and fighting back. And we see a lot of evidence of that. We've certainly seen a lot of evidence of that you've well covered over the last, few years. But I think it's been a slow build, and people are just sort of sick and tired of being told, it's almost like being gaslit by, our employers, being told everything's good and knowing it's not, right? And so I think people are getting sick of that.
Now, over the 18 plus years we've been doing this little program, we've seen virtually every gimmick, every scheme, every opportunity to go after working people and legislators across this country. And you look at, right now there's talk of the head of Trader Joe's, the Bezos guy, the other guy, the Musk guy, they're pushing this lawsuit to go after the National Labor Relations Act. And look, this has been decided law for decades, much longer than either one of us have been alive. And yet we've got a political system that has put people onto a Supreme Court where I don't know that they don't overturn the NLRA.
Yeah, I mean, that concept, the idea that what is it, 70, I can't do the math that fast in my head, but 70 plus years of settled law regarding how
almost 90.
Is it 90?
Almost.
Oh, yeah, okay. the idea that would be, I think probably 5 years ago, Rick, if we were talking about this, we would have thought that would be unthinkable. But we've seen the Supreme Court take some pretty subtle law and upend it, right? On other issues in the not too distant past. And so I think, I think it is part of this sustained attack to really try to make, to really try to convince people that the enemy is their fellow worker or their unionized worker or something like that, as opposed to, really what we're fighting, which is greed and those moneyed interests you mentioned, and really just fighting to have the basics, like safe working conditions, right? Like some say, over the time, place, and manner of our, of our employment. So we're not just being, being scheduled whenever we, somebody doesn't beholden to just schedule changes at the last minute and upend their whole day, right? And fair wages, maybe a little retirement security, it's not a lot, I think, that workers are asking for. And I think that, I don't know. I think it's a different conversation now, but I think I'm still an optimist. And I really think that the NLRA is here to stay.
I hope you're right. But, you know, something as simple as wage theft. I mean, simple as getting paid. And I've said this all the time. You know, I've been a union member my whole life. I've never been cheated out of a dime. There was a couple of times where they tried, filed a grievance, got paid, but have never been cheated. And, you know, something that simple, you know, my fear is if you do overturn decades of decided law and we now have employment chaos, who benefits from that? It's certainly not me. It's certainly not you. It's certainly not the working people.
No, it's not. It's those same people who are, fighting us, right? And we're fighting and trying to get it upended, right? There's a reason the names that you listed at the top are the ones who are behind that push, right? Because they want to hoard more of the money. But, you know, I mean, you mentioned wage theft. We see it in our industries, right? It is rampant already. And you know, the Department of Labor, so many state agencies, they try to make sure that they're taking, you know, investigating and finding and all that. But it's already rampant. So you're right. If this whole system gets upended, I don't even know, almost 90 years. I don't even know how you unravel 90 years of something, but it will be chaos, employment chaos, as you said.
We got Janus, we overturned Roe, this court. I don't know. But, you know, I got to ask you though, you know, you said wage theft is rampant, not with your members, right?
No, in our industry. Sorry, I hope I didn't misspeak on that. Because we have contractors who are partners with us and they treat their workers well, but you have a lot of unscrupulous folks in the construction industry who want to exploit people who just need jobs. And that it's wage theft, which is bad enough, but it's also bad safety conditions and all those other things we listed earlier.
Yeah. Lastly, you know, I got to get your thoughts on this, because look, to me, ultimately, this is a political issue. It's who we elect, you know, at election time. It's who we put into the office of power who makes these decisions. And, you know, I've said for years, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they've done. A lot of this is them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the extreme Republicans that we're seeing in Congress and in state houses who are really pushing, you know, these laws and these takebacks of things is right. It's a political thing. I think it's very hard, right? We have to just make sure people understand, or we have to, you know, have conversations, right? We have to have conversations like this. We have to have conversations with people who don't agree with us on everything, right? And make sure that truly they understand who are the people fighting in their best interest and who are the ones who are not. And that, to me, it's very clear. I think it's hard with all the misinformation and things out there. It's hard always to discern that.
I'm right there with you. Liz, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
I'll do that. Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Liz McElroy, Vice President of Government Affairs with the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Check out their website, iupat.org. We'll get links out on social media. For our Free Speech TV audience, thanks so much for tuning in. For our radio affiliates across the country, we're going to take a quick break back after this. Stick around.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, congressional testimony by the national president of the Council of Prison Locals, American Federation of Government Employees, testified in front of Congress at the Senate Judicial Committee, Subcommittee on Criminal Justice and Counterterrorism. And this is one of those things that, as I watched it, I'm like, is it really this bad? Is the pay that low? Is the staffing levels that bad? And who would then want that job? So I had to reach out to our friends at the American Federation of Government Employees and say, can we get Brandy Moore on the show and walk me through some of this stuff? Because I got to tell you, we got to make sure our working folk are safe, especially in the jobs that help protect us every day. And that's why I've asked Brandy Moore to come talk with us. She is the national president of the American Federation of Government Employees Council of Prisons. Brandy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So is it as bad as what I'm reading? I mean, your staffing levels are the numbers that I saw were almost 44,000 that you used to have. You're down to just over 34,000, almost 9,000 staff short than what you had been. That seems like a lot.
It's a tremendous amount. If you heard me testify yesterday for a while, Council Prison Locals has been saying that we've had a staffing crisis. And yesterday I said, we have graduated from a crisis to a catastrophe. We have 121 federal prisons across the United States. We start most days at every prison with holes in our roster. So empty spots, and they've gone from telling us we have to do more with less to individuals who didn't hire on as correctional officers. Maybe they hired on as a teacher or a nurse or to work in food service. It's a process called augmentation, and they pull us from the positions that we were assigned to do to backfill into correctional officers. They are mandating overtime left and right. Some institutions 2 and 3 times a week. Individuals are being forced to work, 16 plus hour days. It is definitely a catastrophe. 8,900 is a huge number.
No, it sounds like a huge number. And, but one of the first things that came out, as I thought of this, I'm going, well, I know someone's going to go, well, we let a lot more people out, so we don't need as many people to man the prison. I'm going, no, that's not how it works. You tell me, because we've let people out. Do we need more? Do we need the same number of correction officers to watch a smaller number of people in these institutions?
Right. So, and that's the general perception is, if we let the inmates out, we'll need less officers. That's not entirely true. So in prisons, we have what we call a housing unit. And typically you house anywhere from, 60 to 120 inmates per housing unit. You need an officer in each of those housing units, whether you have 20 inmates in there or 120 inmates. The Federal Bureau of Prisons doesn't do a staff to inmate ratio. So it's not like, if you have 30 inmates, you have to have one correctional officer. And that has always posed a problem. But in the federal system, the inmate population ebbs and flows. So I've been in 20 years or 2 decades, as Mr. Senator Cotton referenced yesterday, made me feel a little old, but 20 years, our population has skyrocketed to the point that we were triple bunking inmates. We have, decreased down to some of the lower numbers that they've seen over the last 50 years, but we continue to need staff regardless of whether that number is up or down at the moment, because it could change at any moment depending on laws and legislation and stuff like that. So it is a very true misconception that if we let inmates out, we would need less staff. That's not true at all.
No, because you still have doors to watch. You still have things that have to be secure, whether there's one person in there or 100 yeah. people. You still need a number of people to ensure that things are well secure, because we don't want people running around, and we certainly don't want people, you know, harming these officers. And you said, you know, what is the staffing level? Because you said, you know, 30 to 1. I don't know if I'm a correctional officer, if I'm thrilled being around by myself of 30 people.
At 30 people, never. I'm not a correctional officer by trade.
Okay.
But do get augmented to correctional posts frequently. And the institution I'm assigned to is, it's situated much like a army barracks. And so it's what we call open bay housing. There are no cell doors like you would see on TV. A lot of our mediums and high institutions have individual cells, but a lot of our lows and camps, it's open bay barracks. So it's portioned off. So there's two bunks in a cell, but there's no door. And so the first time I was augmented to a housing unit with 120 inmates, and I was alone. I was the only officer. And the way my housing units are set up is there's an A side and a B side. And on day watch, you are the only officer for both sides. And there are double doors and a hallway in between the two. So if I'm on the A side and I say, you know, hey guys, get ready for count, and I go through and count them, I have to go through a double set of doors, door, hallway, door to get to the B side. So there's no way to fully supervise, I guess we would say, both sides of that. And that's
wow.
That's true for a couple shifts. Morning watch has the same amount. Evening watch, because there's more activity in the evenings, has two officers. So there's an officer on the A side and the B side. When you get to a little higher level, like the mediums and the highs, the staffing is a little different. And also you have cell doors. So you could actually, you know, lock them in. We lock in the inmates for count, but at the lows and the camps, you don't do that. So the first time we had an actual lockdown and I was augmented to the unit, you literally have to go and say, get on your bunks, and trust that they will get on their bunks. And then you go to the B side of the housing unit, and, you know, have to trust that they're going to do the right thing. And it's just, it's very different than what you see and what Hollywood has portrayed prisons to be.
Right. No, you keep using the word augmented. And I want to highlight on that for a second, because if I understand this correctly, augmented means not fully trained. Because you said a second ago, you're not a corrections officer.
Correct.
You know, so you've been pulled in to do that job. Are you fully trained?
So we get the same training as correctional officers.
Okay.
In the Bureau, we all get sent to a 3-week training course. We get the same training. However, I will say that I don't think augmenting or pulling non-correctional officer staff is as safe as having a correctional officer there. That corrections officer bids on a post quarterly. And so if they go to a housing unit, say a housing unit, and they're assigned to that housing unit for that whole quarter, and they get to know the inmates in that housing unit. They understand, like, this gang, you know, kind of runs this area, and these individuals are over here, and they kind of know what to look for, and they build kind of a rapport with the inmates. Whereas if I work in, you know, food service or health services or facilities and I get augmented, I don't know those inmates like that. I don't know what happened in that housing unit yesterday. I don't know, you know, the day-to-day running or operation of that housing unit. So while we do get the same amount of training, it's still not quite the same. It would be, you know, like you pulling the mailman to deliver the milk today. They, you know, they get the concept, but it's not really the job that they were hired to do.
No, so that's an excellent point. And I'm glad you made that, because I think it's important to understand, you know, what we're doing in these situations. And look, I got to imagine that if you're someone who's on a post with someone who's been augmented in, I don't know that you're going to feel as safe as you're going to be with someone who's been there and understands and does what you do. Or am I throwing too much into this?
No, and I mean, you're right in some aspects. In some aspects, you know, we say we're a family, and if there's an emergency, we run. So, you know, sometimes that you have gained the trust of that officer that you're working with or whatever, and they know that you're a solid individual. And then there are sometimes they're like, huh, this person's not a correctional officer. I don't trust them the way that I would trust someone who works this post with me every day. So.
Right. Because, you know, I'm trying to figure out, I'm going, you know, federal government employment is usually something desirable. I'm trying to figure out why you have a staffing shortage, why the numbers are so low. Is it that you can't get people? Is it that the, you know, that the people at the top have said, no, we're slashing and cutting because Congress isn't giving us enough money? Why do we have this shortage? And because you said yourself, we're crisis level here. How'd we get here?
So I think it's a combination of the perfect storm. When I hired on 20 years ago, the pay was very good. The benefits were very good. My generation and above looked to retirement and stuff like that. Pay and benefits have not kept up with times. I can go to Walmart or Bucky's in a lot of states and make what I make as a 20-year careerist in the Bureau. And so the pay is not attractive anymore. And a lot of the younger generation, they don't see the benefits of retirement and stuff like that. So the pay and benefits not being competitive anymore is the first part. The second part is there has just been a downtick in law enforcement positions in general over the last several years. You know, there's been horrible news stories, and used to law enforcement officers were very proud of their jobs, and even corrections officers. You know, now, like, I'm hesitant to even walk in Walmart with a seal on my chest because you never know how people are going to respond to that. And so the perception of law enforcement in general being downgraded. And then it's also in 2016, the administration decided, and I say the administration, I'm told it came from the president down, decided that we had 6,000 positions that were vacant and they were just going to put a hiring freeze. And with that, they froze the positions. And since then, the union has been sounding the alarm saying, you have to fill these positions. And even in the times that we can get them to agree to fill positions, we no longer are attractive. We're not competitive with Border Patrol and ICE, which are two other federal law enforcement entities. They make on average about $37,000 a year more than my corrections officers. Wow. And so even if we do get them in the door, we're just a stepping stone for them to get to another federal agency. And when I started 20 years ago, we literally had people that would use the state as a stepping stone to get time under their belt to come into the federal system. And that's not the case anymore.
Right. Now, that's what I remember. I remember, and I know my union represents a number of the county prisons in our area, and they're paid much better than what, yes, what I'm seeing that you guys, your corrections officers are getting. And that's a problem. I mean, because ultimately, you know, when you're talking about the federal prisons, in a lot of places, these are some of the, you know, some of our worst offenders, at least I think these are some of our worst, yes, offenders. And look, you know, I fully support law enforcement, you know, when they're not wrong, when they're doing, right, their job and they're out there protecting people and they're giving it their best. I'm 100% behind them. And I think the majority of people are. So I want to, yes, thank everyone who does their job and does and puts in the hours. But I want to make sure they're also safe, taken care of, and well compensated for it.
Absolutely. And I think anybody that's seen anything about the Bureau of Prisons lately, we've hit a lot of headlines, you know, the Epstein deaths, the Whitey Bulgers, stuff like that. You see a lot of negative headlines. But I think, honestly, a lot of that falls back to the lack of staffing. You know, when you have less supervision with inmates, more problems are going to happen. And I literally have said so many times that I honestly think if we can fix our staffing crisis, we fix 90% of the problems within the Bureau.
So how do we get to that point? I mean, you know, the reality is you know, this is a political issue, isn't it?
It truly is. We've looked at my union, my team, my executive team. We've looked at several options from, you know, changing our position descriptions because it's very, I guess, politically driven. My agency has to request through the Department of Justice, who has to request through Office of Personnel Management to up our position descriptions to get a higher pay. Anyway, so honestly,
that sounds like an arduous task. Shouldn't be this difficult.
Truly. I think TSAE fought the same battle for about 20 years before, I think it was last year, the year before, they were actually able to secure a pretty decent increase. But they truly have to fight for that increase every year. And so my team is looking for options, and we have been very active legislatively with our senators and our congressmen to say, what can we do? How can we fix this? We are taking that task head on. We have a couple legislative events each year. We capped one off about 3 weeks ago. I probably had 35 meetings with different congressmen to discuss these issues specifically. And I think that's part of what brought the subcommittee hearing yesterday was I sat down from across the table from a couple senators and said, look, you know, I make $60,000 a year, and that is not attractive anymore. I can go to Bucky's or Walmart, and people aren't spitting on me, and they're not throwing feces at me, and it is not the high-stress environment that we put ourselves in every single day, and we are just not competitive anymore, and we will continue to have a crisis or catastrophe until we implode, and we are not far from that. I say often that it's not if, it's when we lose somebody. And when I say someone, I mean a staff member. If you saw prior to the subcommittee hearing yesterday afternoon, they had my director and the inspector general testifying about inmate deaths. We lose inmates. The percentage is up right now. Again, I relate that back to staffing, but I am super concerned for the safety of our staff, because it is not if, it's when we lose somebody at the levels that we're operating at right now.
No, I think those are both really important points. First, you want to make sure that the people who come to work every day are safe and get to go home at the end of the day, but also the inmates. And you know, having only a small number of corrections officers, I think, again, I've never been in prison, so I don't have firsthand knowledge, but from what I've heard and what I've read, I think you want a little more security, a little more enforcement of the rules. Or am I wrong here?
No, you're spot on. I mean, no one kisses their kids in the morning and wants to have to worry about if they're going to make it home at night. But our correctional professionals do that. I tell my kids I love them because I never want them to wonder, did she love me? Not trying to tear up. That's literally what our staff face every single day. You walk into a prison and it is a different feeling. If you've never been, that gate slams behind you and it is a chilling effect. You are in an environment where no one wants to be there. They didn't choose to be there. They were placed there. Oftentimes, some of the most violent individuals, and don't get me wrong, there are inmates who are a pleasure to deal with. They understand they did a crime. They're there to do their time. They're trying to get the most benefits out of it. But the vast majority of our population is not that way. They are angry at the world, and we have to face those individuals every single day.
So last question I've got for you. Who do we beat up to get some action on this? What legislators, who do we go after? Who's the movement makers?
Right. So I think that's a really hard question. I think that my union does a phenomenal job of bipartisanship. We have senators from both sides of the aisle listening, ready to help. But it's a huge problem. Like I was saying, agency, department, Office of Personnel Management, I'll let this leak, but I have a meeting with the White House tomorrow. I think that the White House can do an executive order or a special pay table, and that would be a much shorter, quicker, safer fix for us than fighting for years to get the pay increase like TSA did. And so I don't know that we beat anybody up, but we continue to knock on the doors. I will go down swinging. I got 5+ years left before I can retire, 15 years before I'm forced out the door. I will not stop. I don't take no for an answer. So we will continue on that path. And whatever that path may be, I don't know what the shortest, best, easiest path is. I do think Congress is our best, shortest, easiest path. But even then, it's not just a quick signature. So
well, good on you for getting out there and spreading the word and fighting for those folks. I wish you the best, and I'd love to have you back on and talk to us again.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'd love to be on anytime.
Good stuff. Brandy Moore, National President of the AFGE Council of Prison Locals. Want to hear your thoughts. Would you want to be a correction officer, especially for, well, the wages that they're making right now? And do you think we could solve that problem by just boosting the wages? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1900. That was the day the members of the Granite Cutters National Union walked out on strike. Their demands were improved wages and the 8-hour day. The leader of the strike was James Duncan, a Scottish granite cutter. Duncan had been elected Granite Cutter President in 1885. He was one of the founders of the American Federation of Labor. He served on the AFL's executive committee and was a close personal advisor of AFL President Samuel Gompers. Most of the granite cutters were located in cities on the East Coast. The union's first local was founded in Maine in 1877. Like many skilled trade unions of its day, under Duncan's leadership, the organization did not welcome black members. Duncan actively encouraged employers in the South to hire only white granite cutters. The strike of 1900 lasted until mid-May. It ended with a victory for the union, including the 8-hour workday for every local of granite cutters. Because their skills were often in high demand, tradecraft unions were sometimes able to win concessions from employers on matters of wages, hours, and working conditions. These victories by skilled craftsmen helped pave the way for the 8-hour workday to become the standard workday for all working people in the United States. The union also won a minimum wage standard and grievance procedure. In 1905, the Granite Cutters changed their name to the Granite Cutters International Union. During the 20th century, changes in technology changed the labor of granite cutting. Machines reduced the number of workers. In the 1920s, the union had more than 10,000 members. But by the late 1970s, it had dropped to less than 4,000 members. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Here's a story that caught my attention. You may have seen this. Former U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, he was Trump's Surgeon General, the 20th Surgeon General of the U.S. I wouldn't put him at the top of the good list, but here's the thing. 49-year-old guy out on a hiking trip, on a business trip out in Arizona, got a little lightheaded, decided he was going to go to the ER. Now, this is a doctor. This guy's a doctor, was the Surgeon General of the U.S. This is a guy who's way up there. So he goes to the ER. And gets a massive bill, a $5,000 bill, just because he went to the ER lightheaded. They did a couple of tests, gave him some fluid. He was probably just dehydrated. So they sent him on his way, in and out, a couple hours, I'm sure. But a $5,000 bill. And he said he was going to fight the bill. You know, he said he's been calling. And it's, how did he put it? It's been mentally taxing. And now the story is, you know, his experience, you know, it's highlighting, you know, big problems with the U.S. healthcare system. You know, it's the exorbitant fees and the high costs and the lack of transparency. And you go, yeah, that's been the problem for a while. Ask any person who's had to go and use our healthcare system in any way, shape, or form, just how expensive it is, especially if you don't have insurance. Especially if you're one of these people who go, I gotta pay the bill out of my pocket, or I've got enormous deductibles that I can't not pay the bill. Again, our healthcare system, we got real problems. So the Surgeon General, the former Surgeon General, now sees it. Do you know when this epiphany would have been helpful? I don't know. Maybe when he was Surgeon General and he could have advocated for something to be, I don't know, helpful. But no. That's not what's going on. And the reality is you've got massive medical debt problems in this country. There was an analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Peterson Center. The Peterson Center, not a group I'm overly thrilled with, but they say that about 20 million people in this country owe medical debt, 14 million people over $1,000. And again, we know that medical debt is the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country, the leading cause of personal bankruptcy. We know this. And what are we doing to fix it? Oh, yeah, the Republicans are, let's repeal and replace Obamacare. Instead of going, hey, let's expand that so no one has to do this. And let's make the deductibles lower. Let's make the plans better. No, we're not hearing that. No. And Jerome Adams is a guy who could advocate for that. But I got a feeling I know what he's going to advocate for. You know, we should have that Wendy's digital billboard. So they put right out on the screen so you can decide which tests you're going to take and pay for. Because, yeah, the first thing I want to do is question my doctor when he says, you need this test. I say, well, you know, the bill on the board's too much. Yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. We need free market solutions, Rick. I'm sure this is the direction that this would go. Instead of saying, you know what, we need to put these places in line. It shouldn't cost $5,000 to go get checked out. That is insane. But it is our system. Now, you go, do you think anything will come of this? No. He got a story in the newspaper. Do you think our friends in Congress are going to do anything? No. Because they're in the pockets of the big healthcare companies. On both sides of the aisle. More of the Republicans, though, because remember, they're the ones who have been since 2010. Stop and think about it. It's been almost 14 years since its passage in 2010. Republicans have been standing in the way of making healthcare better in this country. And corporate Democrats are the reason that we've got a system that relies on the health insurance industry, where we could be relying on ourselves. We could have a program that says, you know, everyone into one pool and brings down the cost of administration, brings down the cost of a lot of things, stronger negotiating. But no. We need the splintered system we have so that we can continue to, well, go after the people who need it the most. Because remember, the free market people who say, well, we should have free market solutions. They know that when you're laying on the ground having a heart attack, the last thing you're going to do is be dialing for deals. The last thing you're going to be doing is going, you know, you got a special on heart attacks this week? You're not. You're going to get me to the hospital as quick as you can. Get me care immediately. Do you care what it costs? No, I want to live. And that's what they understand, which is why when we're not having a heart attack, that's when we should be fighting this stuff. And improving the ACA and improving opportunities for people to get preventative care. $5,000 to go to the ER. Crazy. I want to hear your thoughts. You got any healthcare stories? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the show? Download the podcast. Again, as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.